Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, today we're going to be in the rebellion of Absalom. Absalom was such a handsome young man. Long, dark, curly hair. Apparently he was a very tall, attractive man with an outgoing personality. He was next in line for the kingship, but he couldn't wait. It really goes back to the fact that there were many problems in David's house between his children. There were rapes. There were murders. There was jealousy. There was conspiracy. And it all goes back to Nathan's prophecy in 2 Samuel 12, 10 through 12, about what David did to Uriah and Bathsheba. Now, Absalom, we learned from chapter 14, verses 25 and 26, he really looked much like Saul. He looked like a king, but he just couldn't wait. He was afraid his daddy would pass him by because of the fact that he killed his brother over the rape of Tamar. And so he had to flee himself, and had just recently come back from exile in Syria. Now, it came about after this that Absalom, which means father of peace, Ab, you know, and Shalom, peace, provided himself a chariot, horses, and 50 men as runners before him. Now, this was a sign of kingship. He was already taking on the accoutrements of kingship. 1 Kings 1:5 is a good parallel. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. Now, in the ancient world, the town square was at the city gate, and that's where people came to settle their grievances, like in the book of Ruth. But if they wanted to appeal a decision, they could go to what we might call the Supreme Court, which would be the gate of the palace where the king made decisions. And this is probably where Absalom went. Every morning early, he got up to do that. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel," and on and on. What Absalom was doing, he was trying to say, "I'm available. I wish I was king. My daddy hadn't given me any official appointment, but if I was king, I'd treat you right and you wouldn't have to wait." Here we have one of the obvious problems of the Davidic administration is that he was not readily available. The largeness of the monarchy was growing in its administrative responsibilities, and David just could not keep up with it. Linked to the fact that David, for all of his good qualities, was a terrible parent. And his son here is slowly but surely usurping his daddy's popularity, and he wants his daddy's crown. Now, notice if you would, verse 6. "And in this manner Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the heart of the men of Israel." Now, this phrase, "stole away the heart," is used a couple of times in Genesis where you can see what it means. Genesis 31, 20 and 26. Now look at verse 7. We have a textual problem here. "Now it came about at the end of 40 years that Absalom said to the king." Now 40 years must be an ancient scribal error. And I have a graphic I'd like to show you if I could, please. Notice if you would that 40 is many times in the Bible just a long period of indefinite time. But here it can't be a literal 40 because David only reigned 40 years. We learn from 1 Samuel 5:4. This must have been an example of a very ancient tribal era because it's in all the ancient texts. But there is a recognition by the ancient translations that there's a problem here because several of them have changed the word 40 to the word 4. The Peshitta, which is the Syriac, the Arabic, the Vulgate, which is the Latin, and Flavius Josephus, a commentator during the time of Christ, also has the word 4 instead of 40. And it fits much better because Absalom just returned from exile and hadn't been back a whole long time. "And Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron.'" Now, Hebron, of course, is that beautiful ancient site that had such wonderful connotations with Abraham. And you see a picture of it there, modern Hebron. Now, this is where Absalom was born. This was the site of where David was anointed king of Judah. And you see that in 2 Samuel 2:4, I believe. There was also probably some animosity that David moved the capital from Hebron to Jerusalem, and Absalom wanted to pick up on every discontent he possibly could. Now notice, if you would, where it says, "For your servant vowed a vow while he was living at Geshur in Syria." Now you notice where Geshur is. It's to the northeast of Galilee, and it was a long way away. It was where Absalom's mother was from, and that's probably why he went back to this area. Notice he said, "While I was there, I said to the Lord, if the Lord should indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord." And the king said, "Shalom." And so he arose and went to Hebron. Now, this was a lie. And what made it such a terrible lie? It was a lie in God's name. He was saying, "As the Lord lives, if the Lord let me." He's just lying through his teeth because he wants to go to Hebron, and he wants to take a lot of officials with him under the pretense of paying God back a vow, when all along he's been plotting and conspiring to have himself anointed king at Hebron. So he's lying to his father. He's lying in God's name. It's treasonous, and it's all done under the cloak of religiosity and piety. But Absalom sent spies. Now, the Hebrew word here means to and fro. He sent people all over the land to get ready for this. Throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet..." Now, I've got a graphic I want to show you. It's a beautiful picture of several kinds of zophars, and you'll notice there are several of them. This is the ram's horn, mostly the left horn. It can be soaked in water and spread out, made a long trumpet like that one on the bottom, and you see them there. Notice where it says, when you hear the zophar, that's used for religious and for military communications. Say, "Absalom is king in Hebron." That's what David had been claimed earlier, 2 Samuel 2:4. "Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited, and went innocently, for they did not know anything." Now, here are some of these men. They just went along because they thought Absalom was telling the truth and wanted to pay a vow, and that was the kind of guy Absalom was. He was kind of a showboat type, hot dog type, and they just said, "Well, we'll go along with you, Absalom." But here they're caught now. Absalom's claimed king. They're there. The duplicity seems like it. They're involved, even though they're not. So they're really caught in a bind, and they are leaders in David's bureaucracy. But there they are. Now notice, if you will, in verse 12, "Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel." Now, I've got a graphic I want to show you on him. Ahithophel, notice that I think the name has been changed some. But there's even a possibility that he is Bathsheba's granddaddy. If you check 11:3 with 23:24, if there's only one guy by this name, then this is probably him. Notice the name means the brother of foolishness. Well, that sounds kind of funny for the name of a wise man. I think the Jews very commonly went back and changed the names of people who were traitors or idolaters, and they put the vowels for shame into his name, which is probably Ephethet, and transposed two consonants and changed one of them, put the vowels for shame in. Now, he is known as a very wise man from 1623, and so he was famous for his wisdom. Now, notice it continues then. I think David was more afraid of him than he was of Absalom. In verse 13, "Then a messenger came to David, saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom.'" David realized too late what was happening. "And David said to all his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, 'Arise, let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste.'" Now look at the two reasons. "Lest he overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us. And number two, and strike the city with the edge of the sword." He was very concerned about Jerusalem being captured, and he says, "Better for me to flee than it is to stay and fight." So the king's servant said, "Behold, your servant's ready to do whatever the Lord the king chooses." And so the king went out with all his household with him, but the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. Now this again is going to fall right into the prediction of Nathan in chapter 12, verses 10 through 12. Verse 18, we see these mentioned of some very important people in David's life. "Now all his servants passed beside him, all the Cherethites and the Pelethites." Now, and the Gittites. Now, this group of 600 men were probably part of his original army band that's mentioned several times in 1 Samuel 23:13 and 30, verse 9. Now, this was the larger group of mercenaries that were with David. I think they're called Gathites here in the last part of verse 18, not because they were Philistines, because that's where they and David lived for several years of their life. But I think they probably are Israelis, even though they're called Gathites. Now, notice in verse 19, "The king said to Ittai the Gittite." Now, Ittai was apparently a famous general that had just come to Israel to live. Now, he's going to use God's name down in verse 21. So apparently he had converted religions as well as countries. Now, we find out from 2 Samuel 18:2 that David made him general of a third of the army. So he became a very, very important person. And David said, listen, you've just recently come from your own land, and you've got many servants with you in your family. David said, goes back and serve the king. You're not involved in this. Look at the man says. What loyalty for this guy in verse 21. But Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for life or for death, there also will your servant be. Boy, I want to tell you, that is a pretty strong statement of loyalty, isn't it? Now, this little thing, as the Lord lives, that is an oath. When we talk about oaths in the Bible, we're not talking about cussing, modern sexual terms we use so loosely, or religious terms. We're talking about bringing God's name into a promise, a statement. What we're doing is saying, if there is a God in heaven, and if He is the real God, then what I'm saying is true. And that's how we take God's name in vain, is by those oaths. So David is going to let him come with him. Notice in verse 23, while all the country was weeping with a loud voice, and all the people passed over, the king also passed over the brook Kidron. And it means the dark way. And it's the brook that flows right by the temple area today and separates the Mount of Olives from Mount Moriah and Mount Zion. Now, let's see. Okay, verse 24. Now behold, Zadok also came, and all the Levites with him, carrying the ark of the covenant of God. I've got a picture here I want to show you of the ark, and I'm not sure exactly how good this is, but you can see the representation of the cherubim, the mercy seat in between them, the Acacia wood chest overlaid with gold carried on poles, and that's probably as close as we can get to what it looks like exactly. Now, they set the ark down, and Abathiah, now Abathiah is the high priest, and Zadok is probably the leader of the Levites that brought the ark first, and probably Abathiah came later, maybe even after offering the sacrifice. We just don't know. But both of them are there, and David says, look, go back. Now, David is a very unsuperstitious person. See, that ark of the covenant of God was a symbol of God's power and presence. David said, I don't need that symbol. You take it back to Jerusalem. If God wants me back here, if He's pleased with me, God will bring me back here, and I don't have to worry about it. You take the ark back, men. Stay where you are. Boy, what a great sign of faith. I tell you, David had really, for a few years, his administration had really gone down. But when the crisis hit, the character that makes him a man after God's own heart shines through in this context. What a man of faith he really was. Now, when it says his habitation, the last part of verse 25, that, of course, is the tabernacle. And you see a picture here, the tabernacle in the wilderness. I believe it's probably the same tent. Although there's some discussion about did David design a new tent, we're just not sure. Now, in verse 26, but if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here am I, and let him do to me as seems good to him. David's desire was to do God's will. If it meant dethroning him and exile, that was okay. Look at verse 27. The king said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Now, look at your translation, please, in verse 27. Do you see the word not? It is in italics. When a word is in italics, it means it's not in the original text. So literally what this says is, you are a seer. It's what it has. Now this is possibly, and we're not sure because it's a hard thing, we think it may be a Hebrew idiom of the exclamation, see, or you are a seer, because this man's a priest, not a prophet. And so maybe it's just that idiom of see, behold, that kind of thing. We're just not sure. Now, the two children of these two priests, Zadok and Abathiah, are going to be runners to tell David what's happening at the court. David is going to set up a spy system, if you please, inside the court, so he'll know what's happening. Now, in verse 28, see, I'm going to wait at the fords of the wilderness. And I personally believe that is the crossings of the Jordan River, very close to Jericho, right above the top of the Dead Sea. There were some places where everybody crossed. That's where I believe the Ark of the Covenant crossed originally when Joshua entered the Promised Land. And that's where I think David was going to wait to hear from the sons of these priests about what happened when Absalom came into Jerusalem. Okay? And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and wept and covered his head and walked barefooted. I've got a graphic that I want to show you on some of the signs of mourning through here. Weeping aloud. We get the loud weeping back from an earlier verse with the people, where he covered his head, probably with his robe, and then barefoot. That was a sign of humility. See Deuteronomy 25:10. And later on in verse 32, another man has a torn coat and dust on his head. These are all signs of mourning. Now, where it mentions here, and all of them were weeping. And friends, when Orientals weep, they don't cry in their handkerchief. They just boohoo, loud, wail, shriek. And now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators of Absalom. Now, I believe this was the sons of the priests that brought this information after Absalom entered the city. And they saw this revered counselor at his side. They came and told David. What a discouragement it was. And David seems to be more upset about that than he is about Absalom's military might. Notice in verse 32. And it happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped. Now, what we have here is a local reference to a high place on the Mount of Olives. Now, these high places were not condemned. They were very active in the period of Judges, and apparently active with Levites running them for a long period of Israel's history. But they became idolatrous and connected with the worship of Canaanite fertility cults. And so they were condemned, and they tried to eliminate under Hezekiah and Josiah, but it never really worked. And so here's one on the Mount of Olives. And behold, Hushai, the Archite, met him with a torn coat and dust on his head, sign of mourning. And David said to him, if you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me. Well, there's several theories about that. One says he was an old, old man because he's mentioned as a friend of David way back in Joshua 16:2 is where his name is mentioned. So he had been a long-time friend of David. He didn't live back in Joshua's time, though. He had been a long-time friend of David and was probably very old. Or the other theory is that he was a man of some renown, which meant that David would have to give him special treatment, right? You know, carry him in a little more respect, to have an entourage of people around him, which would be a problem. So David says, look, friend, I appreciate what you're doing, but you're going to be more help to me if you go back and infiltrate the inner council of the king and try to thwart the council of Ahithophel. And that's exactly what this man does. And really, Absalom's rebellion fails because he listens to this man instead of to the wise counselor that rebelled with him. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in times past, so you will now be your servant, and then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. I think David, and he even asked God to take away Ahithophel's wisdom and thwart it. So David is doing something here we may think is unchristian in the sense of unethical. But friends, we're in the Old Testament. A man's son has just plotted and rebelled against him. Absalom would have had to kill David to take over the kingdom. And so David sends these men back with lies to infiltrate the palace. And apparently, it's just mentioned as an offhand way of what David did. Notice in verse 37, so Hushai, David's friend, came to the city, and Absalom came to Jerusalem. Now, we know from later chapters that he had several thousand people with him. He had 12,000 troops that were available immediately to pursue David and overtake him. And that's what Ahithophel said, do it right now. But the other counselor, Hushai, said, oh, no, let's wait a while. If Absalom would have pursued David immediately, the war would have been over because David had all his family and children. He had his 600 fighting men, but he had all their families. They had no way to fight. They were completely in disarray. And so we have a real example here of God dealing behind the scenes to fulfill his will in ways that seem so minor, but in the end make all the difference. And that's what 2 Samuel 15 is really all about. Isn't it a tragedy that this had to happen in the life of David? You know, David is such a great man. The Bible calls him a man after God's own heart. But you know, when I look at a man like David, I'm so glad that God can love a sinner. David was a thief and a mercenary. David, for years and years, although he would not kill Saul, he still did many things that we would think were inappropriate as a mercenary to feed his troops. You know, when he saw Bathsheba, lusted after her, got her pregnant, became fearful because her husband would not come home, and even on his days off, he would not go into his wife. And then this very faithful man, he plotted his death in the name of the king, and then tried to cover this up. friends, David was a great sinner. You can see it in Psalms 32 and Psalms 51. All of his trouble in his family comes from that. I really think the reason he was not a good judge is because he was so nervous about trying to give other people justice when his life was so full of injustice. He was nervous about deciding the morality of cases when his life was so scarred by immorality. Well, I think what we have here is a man like us. If God can love King David, God can love us. But I want to say to you, because you're a godly man, because you try to walk after God, because you have a good heart, does not automatically mean you're going to be a success in every area of your life. David was an utterable, miserable failure as a father. He was an absolute failure. Solomon is going to be the very same way. Now, isn't it funny that men who spend... The Bible records great men who love God but do not spend time with their families. Eli, Samuel, David, Solomon, right in a row. Great men of faith, but terrible, terrible fathers. I think there's a word here to us. I think there's two words. Number one, be it known, what you sow, that shall you reap. Galatians 6:7 is a pretty powerful verse. David played fast and loose with another man's wife, disrupted that man's family, and God said, David, I'm going to disrupt your family. Friends, I want you to know that what you sow, you're going to reap. And the other thing I think it's saying to us is, a good man is not automatically a good husband and a good father. We have to work at it. It takes time to build into our children a godliness that they reflect who we are, not what we tell them to be. Our children will pick up on our priorities. They will see our lifestyle. And our lifestyle quite often screams at them louder than the little moral things we say to them. I think that's in here. Now, I want to mention to you that I don't know how often you struggle with problems in the Hebrew text. Many people get nervous when I start talking about that this thing is not right and that thing is not right, like verse 7. Let me just say to you, I hope you'll get every English translation you have in your house out and look up verse 7 and see if any of them have the word for in it. It's very hard to describe briefly textual criticism. It's easier to talk about the New Testament than it is the Old Testament. Just to say briefly to you, did you realize until 1947, with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls around the Dead Sea in Israel, that the oldest copy of the Old Testament we had was 9th century A.D. Now, we had the Septuagint, that's about 250 B.C., but we didn't have a Hebrew text. With the finding of the Dead Sea, we have been able to see that the text that we have, known as the Masoretic text, is very good, but there are several Hebrew manuscripts that are obvious from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Masoretic text is only one family, one line of that. So sometimes we have to go with other ancient translations who preserve the original where the Masoretic text does not. I know that's confusing. There are several good books on textual criticism. The one that I use is by Greenlee, and I hope you'll think about buying that if you're interested. I have really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.